good afternoon, Juno. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you're listening to KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're looking at rain and snow showers out there. Well, we've been looking at them all day long. Snow accumulation less than an inch, however, on this. Tonight, the clouds are going to decrease. It's going to cool off a little bit. And then Saturday, we're looking at mostly cloudy with patchy fog in the morning. Scattered snow showers in the afternoon, and the high is around 34. So weather outlook for the next couple of days. Today on Juno Afternoon, we've got a nice lineup of guests here. Some folks are coming down from the School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast, and we'll be hearing about course offerings that they're getting ready to put on starting next week, I think, out at the university. There's a new organization called Noble Paws, which is working a way to provide sled dogs for people with disabilities, so we'll hear from Steve Vick and Nene Wolf about that. The Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Fireside Lectures are coming back, and there's one tonight, Polar Bears in Alaska's Chukchi Sea, so the speaker will join us and tell us about that. And then Arlesia Jones and Amy O'Neill are coming in, and Amy O'Neill Hauk, and they're coming in to talk about their poetry reading at the library on Sunday. Right now it's time for National Native News, and stay tuned for the rest of Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma is one of 5 communities across the U.S. included in the first phase of a new initiative. The Obama administration is hoping it will spur economic growth. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has more from Washington.
So-called promise zones are intended to give depressed communities a leg up when it comes to securing federal dollars. Administration officials say the Choctaw Nation and the others stood out because the communities are already doing impressive work. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says the Choctaw Nation is already devoting resources to science and math training at the university level.
They also recognize the importance of infrastructure investments that will help to create jobs and strengthen the tribal area for future economic development. And they are committed to the next generation with a true commitment to early childhood.
Vilsack says they're also looking to diversify their economy with a focus on local and regional food systems.
What the Promise Zone opportunity will create for them is the ability for the federal government to partner with this plan and this vision.
The administration says it's still waiting for Congress to pass legislation to ease the tax burden in these Promise Zones. Officials also say other tribes in places like Arizona and New Mexico are all well suited to be chosen in the next round. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
In Alaska, Bernice Joseph is being remembered for her leadership in education. The 49-year-old passed away this week. She was a former professor and administrator at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, she maintained strong ties to rural Alaska.
Bernice Joseph's longtime friend Kathy Mayo says Joseph's passion for education was reflected in her devotion to young people and her joy in seeing them succeed.
Loved developing students, loved sharing their ideas, advancing ideas, and she really put a lot of that to work in the state.
Joseph followed the example of her mother, who earned a college teaching degree while raising a family of 7 children by herself in the western Alaska village of Nulato. Joseph earned a bachelor's degree at UAF and then an MBA. She was working on doctoral studies before being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2012. Joseph was a Koyukon Athabascan who was born and raised in Nulato. And Mayo says Joseph worked tirelessly to strengthen Bush communities and their next generation of leaders.
Developing our villages was very important to her, developing leadership in the villages to advance their goals.
Joseph was an assistant professor at UAF's Department of Alaska Native and Rural Development. She was later promoted to Vice Chancellor for Rural, Community, and Native Education at UAF's College of Rural and Community Development. She also served as Deputy Commissioner of the State Department of Community and Economic Development. She earned many awards, including the Alaska Federation of Natives 2012 Citizen of the Year. But Mayo says Joseph was much more than an academic or leader. She loved her family and her people. For National Native News, I'm Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Alaska.
In Canada, a Manitoba First Nation is dealing with an outbreak of H1N1 influenza. The CBC reports there are dozens of cases at the Garden Hill First Nation. The community reportedly ran out of flu vaccines while waiting for a shipment to come in this week. Three people were airlifted for treatment from the First Nation to Winnipeg, more than 300 miles away. First Nation officials say flu numbers are worse than last year. Past conditions closed schools and other public places to try and prevent the spread of the illness. Today we remember Chickasaw Nation Governor Cyrus Harris, who passed away this week in 1888. Harris was an advocate for Chickasaw people before and after removal from their traditional homelands east of the Mississippi River to Oklahoma. He was the first elected governor of the Chickasaw Nation after the tribe's constitution was adopted in 1856. He served five different two-year terms until 1874. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PICCLICKGIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6.5 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore hosting Juneau Afternoon today, and it's my great joy and pleasure to introduce three ladies who are up to their ears in management. This is the School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast, and Charla Brown, who was here about a week after she hit Alaska, I think, and was one of my interview guests when she was beginning her work as the Assistant Professor of Human Resource Management up there, is back. Julie Hamilton, Assistant Professor of Accounting, is here. And Katie Jordan, who actually runs the entire School of Management.
Thanks, Beth. Yes.
Katie is the
Community Outreach Coordinator.
Community Outreach Coordinator, but she's the person who keeps everybody else in the place on task here and like that. So you're going to – business starts Monday, right? The heavy-duty business of instruction and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
That's
right. What's new at the School of Management? What are we offering this semester that we've never done before kind of thing? Anything?
Well, I can't say there's anything particularly new, but we are putting a strong emphasis in our human resource concentration, as evidenced by the role that I was brought in to fill. And we're very excited because we have a number of courses that are being offered this spring. We actually have a few with some remaining spots if anyone's interested in getting in the program. But we are offering principles of human resources management. We are offering introduction to business, introduction to marketing. So anybody who's thinking about courses that they could take from in an online environment, because the majority of our courses are distance delivered, but they're very high touch with the student, very applied projects, and that high touch experience where they have a connection with the professor, even though it may not necessarily be in the classroom.
And accounting now used to be a big part of the School of Management. Still a major component.
Yeah, it's still very big. We have quite a few students. We do get a lot of transfer students who come in and they're in there for their last couple of years because the distance component is so strong for accounting at our school. We're doing a few new things, trying out some more outreach for how we do our classes distance. We're trying to deliver a little bit more live and interactive rather than, you know, taped and asynchronous type of courses. So we're reaching out to students that way. We still have some classes, some spots available for students who are interested in maybe trying out some intro accounting classes this semester. There's one that's called Record Keeping for Small Businesses, and that's offered Monday and Wednesday nights. That's great for people who either own their own business, want to start their own business, or perhaps just want to see if they're interested in accounting and want to go on with accounting.
Mm-hmm. QuickBooks the center of that?
That one is not. We do offer a QuickBooks course, and that can be taken after you take the intro.
Intro accounting and then QuickBooks.
Right,
I know
lots of
small businesses use QuickBooks. And it's
right. We do have a QuickBooks class.
It's got a vertical learning curve.
right, definitely. And we offer that one every semester. Sometimes it's live and in person, and sometimes it's distance.
Cool. The school is largely distance. Is it possible to actually completely finish a degree by distance?
Yes.
It is? Okay.
And we're serving students across the state of Alaska. So we do have some local classes, and actually one new thing this academic year is that we're doing kind of blended classes where we have local Juno students that would sit in front with the instructor on the Juno campus for a live lecture, and then people are piping in across the state to participate, which has been really popular and definitely more interactive.
It is. That does change the dynamic of the online classroom, because if it's just the professor working with a headset or something like that, there's a kind of a less excitement happening or something like that, because when there's the moment of being able for everybody to talk around. Yeah.
And it's a great, it's allowing our students to connect with peers across the state and, you know, maybe even build friendships or even recruit their friends to come to our school. So it's definitely interactive.
The other wonderful thing about offering the courses online is that it's not an 8-to-5 deal. Someone who's working can finish a degree or work on a degree as they continue working, because a lot of the courses are offered in the evening or so that they can accommodate folks.
Either in the evening or asynchronously, for example. So I have a number of students.
Asynchronous basically means?
So they don't have to be at a designated point at any time in the course. So like, for example, last semester I had a number of courses and they were all asynchronous. So the students could log in at their convenience. They could work on the projects at their convenience. Now, they did have a team project where I may have had a student in Anchorage, Nome, Kodiak, and Ketchikan working on an assignment together. And I really emphasize, you know, Katie kind of touched on this. We are a community across all of Southeast Alaska and the state. And so I really emphasize people connecting and maybe getting on LinkedIn, using that as a business networking site, so that you can not only help yourself when you need assistance in the future, but you can also help others. And so I have a really fun assignment. Well, I think it's fun. I'm not sure what the students think, but I'm have them go through a series of, because for some people it's kind of a new concept. Some people are already doing it. So everybody kind of starts in a different place. But as we go through the semester, they can kind of, it's a journal. They can kind of reflect on these networking experiences.
The opportunity to network with digital or with online instruction is really totally different than it is in the classroom, because in the classroom it's just the people in that class. But the wonder of this is that you can be in a networked situation with people in Nome, villages, all over the state of Alaska, maybe even outside. I don't know. Do you offer courses? Do you have students outside the state?
Oh, yeah. Last semester I had students that were in, I think there was one in Minnesota, one in New Jersey, and I think one in Texas as well.
So, you know, this could be part of your project and could become part of your network. There's some real opportunities
absolutely.
There.
And because we serve, because primarily our student base is working professionals, that means our students can connect with someone that's in a similar position as they are, you know, as an employee, and use those work experiences in their class, share what they're doing, learn from other students about their own work experiences, and then, again, apply that to what they're learning.
So let's get down and dirty here. Monday is the start of classes. If somebody wants to take advantage of these things we're talking about, what do they need to do?
So they can go on to our website, uas.alaska.edu, and from there you can look at the class schedule. You can look at how to get registered. You're going to register at uaonline.alaska.edu, and you can do that until January 19th. Of course, you can go to the Juno campus directly to the registrar's office, fill out the course registration form, and get registered that way.
Okay. And I guess classes start Monday. Do you know, but your start dates are probably a little staggered. Are they like throughout mm-hmm. this week or throughout the semester? Do you have some short courses or not?
Well, my courses, for example, I will have them available on Monday, but because it's back to that
because of the asynchronous,
so we kind of, through a course of a 7-day period, we'll have material that we'll cover, and so my students will all drop in next week at some point when it's convenient for them.
Is it still it's still possible, I think, during the registration process for an online course, you can actually order the textbook and the whole thing right through the website? You don't really have to go out normally. You can.
To the bookstore? No, you can get everything online. Most everything can be done from your own desk. But
And one of the things that happens is, like, let's say somebody registered late and they need to order the textbook. It does take some time for the textbook to get here. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times the professors will make that first or second chapter available so that as they have reading assignments that they need to complete, the material is all available for them while they're waiting for the textbook. So we make it as user-friendly as possible for them.
Yeah.
And the bookstore does have some books available as well out at Off Bay.
But if you're going to register late, we would definitely recommend that you contact the instructor and just give them a heads up that you're coming into the classroom and find out what you've missed.
So the UAS semester about to roll out here, and the School of Management offering some really exciting opportunities, and almost all available in an online circumstance, so folks can continue making a living and work on their college degrees or pick up the last few credits they might need or start the whole thing and work their way through the process. Thanks so much for coming down and telling us. The folks we've been listening to are Charla Brown, Assistant Professor of Human Resource Management, Julie Hamilton, Assistant Professor of Accounting, and Katie Jordan, who is the Community Outreach Coordinator at the School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast.
Thank you
so much for updating us and letting us know what's going on out there.
This is Bird Note. There's an element of luck in bird watching, and sometimes that luck is mostly bad. A birder may find a particular bird so elusive that after many unsuccessful attempts to see it, the bird becomes a kind of jinx bird.
This is the most diabolical bird ever invented.
Can a bird truly be equated with bad luck? Europeans centuries ago believed so, for the very word jinx and its connotation of a spell of bad luck comes directly from a bird's name. The bird once called the jinx, J-Y-N-X, is the bird known today as the Eurasian wryneck. When a wryneck, a brown and gray-toned bird about the size of a small woodpecker, is threatened at its nest hole, it twists its head sideways like a snake and hisses. This anomalous behavior led to the wryneck being invoked in witchcraft to put a spell or a jinx on someone.
I put a spell on you!
Today, the Eurasian wryneck seems harmless enough, although its scientific name, Jinx torquilla, honors its neck-twisting, bewitching reputation. Has a bird put a spell on you? Well, let us know on our Facebook page. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine.
I'm like my dog. She's got an interesting pedigree. She likes to eat, and she's got big feet. Like I said, I'm like my dog, and she's like me. Well, I found this hound. If you get me out of this place, come, I am longing to be free. And I'm like my dog, and I like my dog. She's got an interesting pedigree, just like me. She likes to eat, she's got big feet. Like I said, I'm like my dog, and she's like me. soft and sweet. She likes to walk down the street.
Well, Little Like My Dog is the appropriate music for our next guest. There is a new organization and a nascent organization, I guess, called Noble Paws, and two representatives are with me here. Steve Vick is coming in by telephone, and we'll connect to him in just a second. And Nene Wolf is here in the studio with me. So welcome, Nene. And welcome, Steve.
Oh, hey, welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Nene is whispering over here. So, and Steve, I think you can hear her. Can you put the headphones on and then you can hear him? Okay, so here we go. I went out on your website and got a look at it, and it really sounds like a fascinating project. The whole idea is that you are in the throes, or have you finished construction on two special sleds?
Oh, yeah, actually, we're in the throes of it. I actually just talked to a sled builder today who was pretty confident he'd be able to build these sleds. They're going to be adaptive sleds for to match people with specific abilities.
Now, on the website, it explained what an adaptive sled was, but not all of our readers have gone there
right yet,
so or our listeners. So, so tell us about adaptive sleds.
Yeah, well, basically what Noble Paws is, it's a nonprofit that's newly formed, and we are going to be we're going to have a dog team that's solely dedicated to serving people that are experiencing disabilities. So the idea behind that would be to have sleds that are specifically designed towards a person's ability, whether they maybe they're paralyzed from the waist down, or they have balance issues, or they're in a wheelchair. And the two of the sled designs that we have are designed so that, well, one is a sled designed so that the back area where the musher would normally stand would fold down, and you could wheel a wheelchair right onto the sled and then lock them in, and then you'd be able to take them for a ride. They would roll right on. And then the other sled design that we have, it's kind of like a trike where you have two wheels in the front and kind of one in the back. We'll picture those two wheels more like snow machine skis, and a seat in the middle, and then hand controls for someone who may be paraplegic to control the sled with their hands and brake and steer.
Ah, so sounds marvelous. And the whole idea here is to give people who may not otherwise be able to undertake this adventure to, the chance to do so, right?
Yeah, it's pretty much exactly it. It's a new form of mobility for people, and give them the option to experience that, some independence and mobility.
Now, you said on the website that you have 20 trained dogs in harness for this already?
Not already, no.
Oh.
I'm an ex-dog musher myself, and we bought some property up in Fairbanks where this will be based out of. And when we get to the property this summer, we'll start collecting dogs. We may lease a team the first year just to kind of help us with overhead, but eventually we'll have our own team. The goal is to start with 20, and we'll probably end up having more like 30 when we're fully functioning.
So do you have to have larger teams to do what you're doing, or is that just so you have multiple teams out?
Well, that's a really good question. We do have to have larger teams because dogs need, you know, their off days, their rest days, but we are hoping to serve people on a daily basis. So we'll have kind of A teams and B teams, or a Monday, Wednesday, Friday team, a Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday team.
So once again, I think you just said where you're going to have the where you're actually going to do the rides. Where will that be?
Yeah, well, we're going to be based out of Fairbanks. We bought a cabin on 5 acres in Goldstream Valley, for those who are familiar with the area. And it's right near the mushing trails there, so it's got great access. The cabin needs a little bit of – well, the cabin's fine, but the land needs work because it doesn't have a dog yard yet and things like that. So we are basically a startup nonprofit.
And so at the moment, I believe you have a fundraising campaign going on. Is that correct?
Yep, we do. We're trying to raise the money to help one build the sleds, which are probably going to be our largest overhead at that point. And, of course, we have we're going to start off right as a nonprofit. We're going to have full liability insurance and all the things that go into that. And then any extra fund that we can raise will go help towards feeding the dog team and kind of covering our operating expenses. As a new nonprofit, we're going to be relying a lot on donations. But as we get going, we'll be applying for grants, and we'll hopefully be having contracts with different programs or different agencies in Fairbanks. I know that some of them are interested in definitely using our services. And, of course, though to start, though, you know, I'll be having several part-time jobs just to make ends meet and to get it going.
Nene, what's your role in the organization?
Oh, well, I was invited about a month ago. And Steve and I have been friends and colleagues and working situation in Haines. And I do have a connection with the musher world in Fairbanks, and have quite a bit of experience with being a veterinarian for these types of dogs. So connections and friendship and interest, of course.
Whose idea?
Steve's idea.
Well, was it, he was the one who thought this out?
Oh, it's been a long time in his mind.
Can you give us a little of the genesis, Steve? What brought the concept to you?
Yeah, gosh, this is a 15-year-old idea I had. When I first started mushing, I was in Healy in 1999 and was a handler for a tour operator there who did tours into the park. And I thought of the idea that winter, and it just kept building. And, you know, at that point I was young, and I didn't have any experience in how to start something like this. You know, running a team is one thing, but running a nonprofit is another. And it got to the point where I had acquired the skills, and I had enough friends who support me, who would help me through it, because I certainly can't do it alone, that it just kind of came to a head, and we said, let's just do it. And we bought the cabin, and now we're all in.
Well, it sure sounds like an idea whose time has come. I imagine there's going to be a huge participation in this. I know here in Juneau that Eagle Crest has assisted skiing programs and has equipment up there, and that is an extremely popular sport for folks who are disabled in some fashion.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's for us, we'll be serving a lot of the Fairbanks population, but it's going to be open not just statewide but nationwide. We've been in touch with Make-A-Wish Foundation and organizations like that. Wounded Warriors is another one that would be ideally suited for. So if we have the funding, we'll help them get up here. But if not, we'll at least have a dog team waiting for them.
You know, we have dog rides up on the glacier here throughout the summer for tourists. Do you have any plans to open up a branch office up on Mendenhall?
Not for summertime, no, not particularly. That's a great operation up there, and we're familiar with some of what they do. But there is the opportunity for a growing segment of mushing is the dryland mushing, where you can do it on carts and bikes, and so adaptive sleds could be built with wheels and be used on trails during the summertime also. So there is potential for year-round opportunities.
I guess we cannot leave the topic here without asking or without making sure that folks know, if they're interested in supporting this operation, what they can do to make donations or to become part of the process.
Oh, I'll give you a couple ways. For sure, you can visit our website, which is noblepawsalaska.org.
P-A-W-S, by the way. Yeah.
Yep, Paws. And,
.org.
Noblepaws, yep, .org. And they're welcome to... email me, which would be steve@noblepawsalaska.org.
Okay. Hey, it sounds like a concept, a dream for a long, long time is finally coming very near to fruition here. We wish you great luck and success, and we hope there are people who will respond with a little of the Gita's necessary to make this dream come true, huh?
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. We were very excited about it.
Well, thanks for telling us about it.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 10th of January, 2014. It's the anniversary of the day, 1901, the first oil gusher erupted at Spindletop just outside Beaumont, Texas, the beginning of the age of petroleum. Until then, most of the oil came from Pennsylvania, and oil and petroleum were used mostly for lamps. But suddenly, with Spindletop, oil became the cheapest fuel, just about 3 cents a barrel. A man named Patillo Higgins thought there was oil there, and he enlisted a Croatian oil explorer named Anthony Lucas. They started drilling in late 1900. Hit a depth of about 1,200 feet, natural gas started shooting out of the ground, followed by crude oil. A gusher, 200 feet straight up in the air. And it was the beginning of the great Texas oil fortunes. Within the year, the town of Beaumont went from 8,000 to 60,000 people. And it was on this day in 49 B.C. that Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon River and launched a civil war. He had conquered most of Western Europe all the way to Britain. But back in Rome, his political alliances were falling apart. His fellow consul Pompey had turned against him, and so had the Roman Senate. The Rubicon River formed the border of the Roman Republic, and according to Roman law, if a general brought his army into the Republic from the provinces, he would be considered a traitor. And so Caesar got to the river with his army, made up his mind, said, "Alea iacta est," the die is cast, and came into the city. And crossing the Rubicon became a phrase meaning past the point of no return. It's the birthday of the historian Stephen Ambrose, born in Lovington, Illinois, 1936, son of a Navy doctor during World War II. Family followed him from post to post and then overseas. The war ended. The father came home, took up a private practice in Wisconsin. Stephen Ambrose was a pre-med student, and in his sophomore year, he took an American history class based on biographies of individuals. The professor said that the students would be completing their own biography of an unknown Wisconsinite, which they would have to use primary research from the state's historical society to write. Ambrose said, "That just hit me like a sledgehammer. It had never before occurred to me that I could add to the sum of the world's knowledge." He changed his major to history, wrote a 10-page paper on an obscure one-term Wisconsin congressman named Charles Billinghurst, and that's how his career was launched. He became the biographer of Eisenhower. Nixon, wrote a best-selling book about the Lewis and Clark expedition, and he wrote around 10 books on World War II, including Citizen Soldiers and Band of Brothers. Here's a poem for today by Jennifer Michael Hecht, entitled On Reading the Letters of the Dead. Why were the dead so timid while they lived? In mind, they step in groans, toes on point to test the sand. Despite traversing seas and rushing gold, they still seem cautious to a madness. Why did they not act more like us? I kid. Still, why were the dead so timid while they lived? On Reading the Letters of the Dead, a poem by Jennifer Michael Hecht from her collection Who Said, published by Copper Canyon Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Seven minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is going to be doing two presentations tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center to kick off this year's Fireside Lecture Series, a very popular and wonderful program that's offered out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center every spring for us. The talks are at 6:30 and 8 p.m. tonight, and it'll be two people talking, Eric Reger. And he's the polar bear expert with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And ADF&G's chief wildlife scientist, Kim Titus, will be joining him. Eric is here in the studio with me. So welcome, Eric. And tell us a little bit about the state of polar bears in the Arctic at this point.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And as many people are familiar with, the polar bear was actually listed under the U.S. Endangered Species Act as a threatened species in 2008. And the basis of that listing was observed and projected loss of the polar bear's sea ice habitat associated with climatic change. especially looking out 50, 100 years into the future. So if you look at the state of polar bears today throughout the Arctic, that is the number one conservation threat to the species, is loss of their sea ice habitat. And the reason that's a concern is because polar bears depend on sea ice as a platform from which to catch seals and thereby to access the really energy-rich reserves of the Arctic Ocean. And so that's the number one concern for the species. That said, there's actually currently a lot of variability in the current status of the world's polar bears. If you look at a map of the Arctic for management purposes, there's 20 to 25,000 of these animals in the world, and they've been divided into 19 subpopulations. And so some of these subpopulations are currently doing poorly and in decline. Others are stable, and some are even increasing. So today, a big theme is that it's a mixed bag, but if you look out long enough into the future, there are concerns for the entire species.
Do we have any way we can talk about how much the sea ice has receded? I know that the most dramatic part of this is that we're beginning to look at the possibility of building a port up there because there may be transpolar freight operations, and currently there are tourists going up into Nome on cruise ships. So that's a huge change from when I was a child.
The melting of the Arctic sea ice is going to bring a lot of changes for the North. From things that you're talking about, like increased shipping, increased potential for offshore oil exploration and development, as many of us in Alaska here are familiar with, and then ecological changes. For the polar bear, in some ways, it's almost more straightforward because you can think of less ice for less number of months, less time that these animals can spend in their preferred habitat doing what they do, which is catching these fat seals and you know, growing to the polar bear is the largest four-legged carnivore in the world. But a lot of more subtle ecological changes, too, as you have more sunshine into the Arctic Ocean, changing temperature, changing species assemblages. So it's in that sense, it's a very exciting time to be doing research in the Arctic, but also a very challenging time, is that I really think we're on the cusp of a lot of big changes, and changes that are environmental, social, and economic. So it's a neat time to be studying polar bears or a whole host of other issues in the Arctic, I believe.
Eric, you said there are 19 subpopulations. Where are the largest ones?
As far as where are the largest bears?
Where are the largest numbers of bears?
That's actually a question that I wish I could answer. For these 19 subpopulations, there's only a handful that we have really good estimates of abundance for the subpopulation. Figuring out how many critters are out there is one of the hardest things in wildlife management. It's hard to know how many rabbits are in your backyard. And then for polar bears, for example, the U.S. has two of these subpopulations. They're the Southern Beaufort Sea subpopulation north of Alaska, which is shared with Russia, the Chukchi Sea subpopulation west of Alaska. Chukchi Sea is shared with Russia, Southern Beaufort Sea shared with Canada, excuse me. But for this Chukchi Sea subpopulation west of Alaska, it's an incredibly remote area, 1.5 times the state of Texas, and the polar bears occur out there at very low densities. And so one of the things we're trying to do with new research in that part of the world is answer exactly the question you asked, figure out how many are out there. Our best estimate is probably about 2,000, but that's based on historic observations, not a very rigorous estimate. So, again, for some of them, we know how many there are. For a lot, we don't, and we're trying to find out.
Bears, the polar bear remains on the threatened species list at this point?
Yes, indeed. Polar bears are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act.
Is there hunter depredation at this point? Does anybody hunt polar bears?
Yes. For thousands of years in the Arctic, these animals have served as a nutritional, a cultural, and subsistence resource for native peoples living in the Arctic. So here in the U.S., there's no sport or commercial hunting. That was banned 30 years ago. But there is a continued subsistence harvest by native coastal-dwelling native Alaskans. And we, working with the Fish and Wildlife Service, work closely with our native partners to manage this harvest in a way that doesn't threaten the persistence of the U.S. polar bear populations.
Many threatened species are highly prized, or at least I'm thinking of like elephant tusk and that sort of thing. Is there anything like that with polar bears? Is there anyone who's poaching on them?
Not to our knowledge here in the U.S. When someone takes a polar bear in a community, many people are aware of it. It's something that the community is aware of and shares and celebrates. There are some parts of the Arctic. We actually have an international treaty with Russia where the U.S. And Russian scientists and biologists and managers work together on this Chukchi Sea population, which is shared between the two countries. There are some concerns about illegal take of polar bears in the Russian Arctic, very low population densities out there. In some historic years, not very good law enforcement. So there are some concerns in the Russian Arctic. In most of the rest of the Arctic, in the U.S. and Canada, very little poaching, to our knowledge, and hopefully we'll keep it that way.
Are all polar bears Arctic, or are there Antarctic?
Nope, animals? Just Arctic.
Just Arctic.
So if you see Christmas wrapping that has a polar bear and a penguin on it, and you want a little fact for your friends, you can tell them that's not maybe
possible.
In Zoom, but that doesn't really happen.
Okay. And so I guess, is there anything that we need to know or about polar bears that I haven't asked about? I mean, you're a wealth of information, and I'm not an expert, so yeah. I'm curious if I've missed a major area here.
Oh, I mean, there's a whole lot to you know, and I can ramble.
So give me a for instance.
Well, I mean, one neat fact,
You
know, they're born at less than 2 pounds and completely blind. From there, they grow into, you know, the largest four-legged carnivore in the world. Looking back
how long does it take a polar bear to mature?
You know, the females will start breeding about 4 or 5 years of age.
By that time, how big are they?
Well, the females, a large female, about 500-600 pounds. But there's a big size between the sexes. So a large male will be 1,200-1,300 pounds. And actually, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2008 began a research program in western Alaska. Again, the Chukchi Sea population had been kind of an unknown. And so we've been studying bears there for the past 5 or 6 years, and we've encountered what, to my knowledge, is the largest polar bear ever captured, sedated, temporarily studied for research, and released alive into the wild. And that was last year in the spring of 2013, and that animal was 1,390 pounds. And that's in the spring of the year when the animals are at their lightest weight. So that guy, you know, in the fall with an extra 100 pounds, 200 pounds of fat would be even bigger. So that's a neat fact. But, you know, the main take-home message is that the future of these animals is likely tied to these global climate issues. And the outlook is fairly grim in the longer term if sea ice loss and climate change continue as forecasted. That said, there's a whole lot that can be done. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, State of Alaska, our native partners, the North Slope Borough, U.S. Geological Survey, Alaska Nanuk Commission, all working together for the conservation of this species. And so in the here and now, I think there's a lot of room for optimism, for working together to manage Alaska's polar bears to the best of our ability.
Well, your expertise is awesome. I look forward to inviting folks to come up to Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center tonight at 6:30 or 8. The program repeats, so you aren't missing anything if you choose to come before or after dinner. 6:30 and 8 p.m. In the Glacier Visitors Center. Eric Reger, whom we just heard from, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service polar bear expert, and their chief wildlife scientist, Kim Titus, will be joining him. The two of them will be talking about the Chukchi Sea polar bears and how they are coping with a melting Arctic Ocean. Good luck with the talks tonight, and I hope you get a big crowd out there.
Thank you very much.
As a special way to commemorate KTOO's 40th anniversary, Juno artist Constance Baltuk has created a special limited edition print from her painting titled Waterfall, Salmon Creek. We're offering 200 prints signed and numbered by the artist as a 40th anniversary fundraising gift for KTOO. To learn more, visit ktoo.org.
It's 14 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next two guests, I think you're both repeats. I think you've both been on the show a couple times. But Arlisha is exciting to all of us to be here in Juneau from Anchorage. Arlisha has a play running out at Perseverance. I think you're actually now on stage, right?
Tonight.
We open tonight.
Yeah. That's an exciting moment
yeah.
for you.
Yeah, it is.
I remember in the interview you did with Amy, you said you were going to be sitting somewhere in the back of the theater.
Yeah, I hope.
Are you going to wear a mustache?
No. It'll be dark. I don't think they'll see me.
No one will know who you are. Right? Okay. Anyway, so Arlisha is the author of Rush at Everlasting, which is, as we said, opening tonight at Perseverance, and we'll be playing through
the end of the month?
February 2nd.
February, yes. Yeah. The last performance.
February 2nd.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you're taking it up to Anchorage?
Yep, and then it'll open in Anchorage February 14th.
Yeah, and this is the world premiere of this play.
Yes, it is.
And if anyone did not read the wonderful interview that was in the newspaper, Amy, I think this was a conversation the two of you had somewhere, and then you took excerpts from it and put it in the paper.
Right.
It was a great conversation between the two of you.
Right.
That's really given me a lot of insight into your writing and like that. Mm-hmm. But there's an opportunity here to get even more of an insight into your writing because you and Amy are going to collaborate on a poetry reading with a couple of other people. I think Ernestine Hayes is coming into this.
Yeah.
And
Emily Wall.
And Emily Wall, the current and a former they call it writer laureate in the state of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, anyway, I've interviewed both of those wonderful ladies on this show and just had a wonderful time. I love Ernestine Hayes's poetry because her somehow, even though she writes in perfect English, you hear that clinket thing in her concepts, and it's just amazing to come across.
Mm-hmm.
So, Amy, what are the two of you going to do together?
Well, I'm just the facilitator. I've organized the reading.
Oh, okay.
And so bringing Arlisha and Emily and Ernestine together on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
And I think we'll have hear work from each of them. I haven't limited them to poetry, so we may hear some theater from Arlisha. And, Ernestine also writes memoir. And then we'll probably have some time for questions, too.
And Emily has done this wonderful thing that it's fascinating because her poetry book and her prose work grows out of her poetry. And so if you've read her poetry, then as you read her prose, you find the poem right there in the middle of the story. And so it's really kind of an amazing thing to have happen.
It's so exciting for me because I haven't met either one of these women, and I know of their work and I've run across it just in a few places. So to get to read with them, and it's like we'll have this three-way conversation going up there and my poetry to come in now, and we're all so kind of different. So I'm really looking forward to it. And if they're listening, I can't wait to meet you guys.
Well, I'm hoping that they are, but Emily's normally in Fairbanks, I think.
Oh,
so
right.
I don't know if she's is she coming down?
Emily teaches here.
Oh, she's here.
UAS.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yep. And
right.
her book of poetry, Live Aboard, I think, is her most recent book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and I think she's working on a project right now about mothers, which is when Live Aboard came out, she read a couple of really interesting poems from that. So I bet we'll hear a little bit more from that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I want to go back to this interview that you did, and of course there was a little hint somewhere in there that I've got to try to exploit if I possibly can. Near the end of the interview, you said that after Rush at Everlasting is opened in Anchorage and like that, then you're going to take a little time off because you're preparing yourself for a play that you're going to start working on.
Right. Yeah, I have another big project lined up.
Okay. Two questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is, what are you going to do during your time off? How are you going to get away from
writers
the idea?
Never take a day off.
I know.
I'm lying, Pat.
Okay. All right. An honest woman takes the floor here. Okay, good. All right. So you're not going to take time off. Basically, what you're going to do is stay away from the keyboard for a little while.
I'm going to
So that the idea can... Mm-hmm. can work.
Yep, and just to get out and move away from the desk and ride my bike, and I have a wooden kayak kit that I'm going to put together this summer that should keep me busy. Just I need that brain space to think away from the office and the paper.
There's a lot of people who know that my former occupation involved teaching a lot in classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I always told my students was that they should never cram for an exam up until the last minute.
Right.
Because the knowledge has to synthesize, and that synthesized process involves building wooden kayaks.
Mm-hmm.
You do something that that forces your brain not to be involved in that mess.
I always think of it as like at night when you look at you go to look at the stars, and if you look at them straight on, you can't see them. Or you can, but they're kind of blurry. But if you look at out the corner of your eye, they're so bright, and they'll just catch your eye. And that's sort of how poetry comes to me, or plays, or if I'm trying to take a turn in the narrative, where do I go from here? It'll just, when I'm doing dishes, all of a sudden, oh my God, there's the idea, you know, and I least expect it.
There's a character in a book that I've been reading who sees a ghost, and she's trying to describe it to someone else, and she says, it's like when you can't remember something, and then you quit thinking about it, and suddenly it's there. I think that's what you're describing.
Yep. Yeah, and you're not forcing it. When you force it, it never works.
I really think that's part of the artistic process. There's two wonderful components about the artistic process that are fascinating to me. One of them is the business of time dilation. Every artist I've ever spoken to understands that process, because when you are in the process, when you're in the zone, for lack of a better term, it literally, the clock doesn't work the same way it does when you are not, when you're in the world.
Right.
So you look up and it's been 4.5 hours, or that's the sun coming up, for God's sake.
Well, for me, I've actually, and with Rush at Everlasting, I mean, I'll sit in my chair writing for as long as I can. And I've gone on record before and say, thank God I have a bladder, because every once in a while I have to stand up. Yeah. And if I would sit there forever. So I think that's my time span. It's the volume of my bladder, which is in the play, too.
How well hydrated.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would want to go. It's a family show. Oh, you are delightful to talk to. I knew that when you started hanging out with Boston Christopher.
Yeah,
right? Yeah,
exactly.
You weren't to be trusted. Anyway, so that's the big project that's coming up. The question is, can you suspend?
Can I suspend?
Yeah.
I believe I can. Alaska really helps with that, because we'll have this beautiful summer again, and I do like to ride my bike. We have a cabin we go to, and hiking and things like that. So I think I can, but I know that I will always, like I had that quote about sneaky writing, and my husband's on the slope, so he can't hear me right now, but I promised him no theater this summer, but I will, when he's out of the house, I'll probably go down and write, just because I can't get away from it. I actually love the act, the muscle act of holding a pencil and writing, whether it's just gobbledygook, it doesn't matter. I just love writing and being engaged with language.
No. Amy asked you another question in the interview that I want to go into, too, and that is, she talked two or three different places about your transition from poetry to stage.
Right.
Well, let's start. I know you brought a sample with you. Show us a poem.
Okay.
And then we'll see where that goes.
Okay. This is just a short poem I wrote. I was trying to teach myself Spanish, and I thought the best way to do it would be to write a poem in Spanish, and that didn't work, but I did get a poem, and then I translated it back to English. This was it. It's called The White Birds. They return in moments, the white birds, to your body, to once more become your body. You are not an empty delta after all. Gone the sudden fox that sprang from the grass, startled you to an explosion of wing and breath, caused you to fly a million ways at once towards infinite sky. One by one the senses come back, the white birds settle, fold their wings, cock their heads, lightly pluck their cool beaks at every pore of your skin. And do they sing? Their brief entire world is song.
Hmm.
So you translated that from Spanish into English?
Yeah, I tried to write it in Spanish, and I was reading Pablo Neruda and, you know, translating his poems very haltingly. I don't know Spanish at all, but I thought this would be a great way to engage a language, and it's so beautiful. And then I had my nouns and some verbs and stuff, and then I translated it back to the English.
Mm-hmm.
And what it did was it made it very, it's very imagistic and very kind of essential down to not a lot of stuff going on. Sometimes I can get really wordy in poems, and it didn't do that. So it's just another way to approach my process.
Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Challenge myself.
So at a point in your writing, you said in the interview, you quit hearing what you were writing and began seeing it as a vision.
Right.
Can you describe that a little bit more?
When I first started as a poet, I would always hear it. And in poetry, it's like a music in your head, and it's a music in your body. There's a rhythm all the time. And when it started to be dialogue with characters, it switched, and I didn't hear them. It was like I was far away from them. I could see people. I see what their bodies are doing. I see what room they're in, you know, how they're feeling about their day, and I would get closer and closer, and it would be months sometimes before I would hear them speak again. So I was really seeing a world and people moving around in it, which is what a stage play is.
So when you realized that, then how long was it before? The two aren't simultaneous. In other words, knowing that you were doing plays and having the transition to vision didn't happen at the same time.
Right. No. Well, the plays started, I think the plays were there when I was a little child, and I have these dreams, and, you know, of course, I'd invent people in my head at night and go to bed and talk to them. But I started writing persona poems right as I was graduating from my MFA program, and they got longer and longer and longer, and I would have these 7-page persona poems. And then I realized one day I was out and I was shopping for the persona in my poem, like, oh, this person would love this blue dress. You know? Wait, it's not real.
No.
And so it just started to dawn on me that I think I'm trying to write plays, because in the persona, a couple people would start to talk and back and forth. And then they had to have a certain world they were standing in. And I didn't know what playwriting was at all. I just decided to try it one day.
Well, we've got a terrific reading coming up, obviously. Amy, you've done a brilliant job putting this one together. Mm-hmm. So once again, it's Emily Wall, Ernestine Hayes, and our guest, Alicia Jones, an opportunity for the three of them to take the stage together and share a kind of a discussion through poetry at the library. What time?
2 p.m. on Sunday. It's free and open to the public.
Which one? Downtown?
The downtown.
Downtown Library. Okay, good. Well, again, welcome to Juno.
Thank you.
I don't know if it's appropriate. I know you say it to actors. Do you say break a leg to
to
producers and directors as well? well, break a leg then.
Thank you.
Everybody ought to go get tickets right now to go see Rush at Everlasting at Perseverance. It's running 7:30 on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
That's right.
Through February 2nd.
February 2nd.
So opens tonight.
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you so much for
for
coming down. Thanks so much for a chance to talk a little bit about poetry. This is KTOO Juno. You're in touch with us on translators. K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay. K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. K201 AM in Gustavus. K220 BT in Hoonah. And K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juno, we're on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. And support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners like you. On Monday afternoon, you'll hear Joan Pardis hosting Juno Afternoon. She's going to be talking about Tuesday's Mudrooms presentation. Matt Felix from the Healthy Indicators Report will drop in. Michael Patterson will come in to talk about his experience as a smoker. And it's National Mentoring Month.